and welcome to the Etonicast. I'm Alex Roy, and as always, I have with me my wonderful and much better informed co-hosts, Edward Niedermeyer. Hello, Edward.
Howdy.
And the brilliant Kirsten Korosek.
Howdy is my line.
And today we have so many topics, it's almost impossible to believe we'll get through them all. Let's begin with Ford deploying self-driving test vehicles to Miami. What do you guys think?
Well, not surprising, really. The location is interesting. And that isn't totally surprising either, based on the action that's happening legislatively in Florida and the openness there. But back at CES, when we were talking to the folks at Ford, there was a lot of discussion around sort of their strategy and their business model, which I think is really interesting. Ed, were you going to mention something about that?
So we have you covered as far as, getting context on this story. Episode number 43 of the Etonicast, we interviewed Florida State Senator Jeff Brandis. So if you're curious to learn more about why companies are looking at Florida as a place to deploy, that episode will be very informative for you. And then episode 48, we spoke with Ford's Jim Farley and Sharif Marakbi on what their whole idea is with in terms of going to one specific city at a time to develop their business plan and sort of what their business plan is. So those two episodes, 43 and 48, will be very helpful to you if you want to know more about Ford's deployment in Miami.
One thing to note, the Cliff Notes are basically what they're pushing, at least publicly, is promoting the fact that they are doing this sort of in parallel dual track business model where they're testing through partnerships with like Domino's and Postmates, and I'm sure there'll be others, sort of the interaction with public and how it might be ordering something and picking something up from a self-driving or autonomous vehicle. And at the same time, but separately, Argo AI, which Ford vested in last year. Actually, was that more than a year ago now already? But they're developing the self-driving system. And so that way they're sort of doing things in parallel, but there's not a lot of overlap yet.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that they're going to be announcing another city in 2018. So do you guys have any guesses?
It's going to be a southern city.
A southern?
Well, of course. I mean, think about it. I mean, I think Florida, there's been a lot more testing going on there than anyone's been talking about because the weather is mostly good, barring hurricanes. And you've got an administration that's, let's just say, you're not going to see a lot of regulation coming out of Florida.
Okay, so I'm going to say, I think it's going to be the Phoenix area. Because Ford has a proving ground already there. And they have done sometimes some autonomous vehicle testing, very short periods of time, when the weather is bad in Michigan and the weather is good in Arizona. And because of the regulatory framework and basically like every autonomous vehicle company is active in, not every, but a lot are active in Arizona right now.
I'm going to agree with you because when Waymo goes, full public availability of their fleet, every manufacturer is going to wish they were there. And whoever's on the ground ready to go head to head is going to be first to fight. And I think Ford wants to be there.
Well, don't forget, Cruise is also there.
Yes, Cruise is also there. But, I'm not as bullish on Cruise as a lot of people. We'll get into that another episode. I'll throw this city into the mix. I think someone's going to make an announcement for New Orleans. And I think it's for the reason that was revealed, was it one or two episodes ago, when we talked to Avery Ash.
Inrix,
yeah. Look at that chart. It's not possible that Inrix are the only people who've done the research and looked at the likelihood and propensity of autonomous ride sharing to work. And that chart has got to exist at every company. And if it doesn't, then that company deserves to go out of business.
Yeah, Alex was referring to episode number 56 with Avery Ash of Inrix, the first in our city series where we talked about Inrix's ranking of cities in terms of their appropriateness as a place to deploy autonomous vehicles. I'll go out on a limb though, and looking at a different Inrix list here, of most congested cities, which Miami is on, is number 5. Right above it is Atlanta, Georgia. And that seems like an interesting place to test AVs as well. They have terrible traffic, as witnessed by their status on this list. And also just if you spent any time there, you know that. It's in the South, good weather pretty consistently, and a booming tech sector. So, it may not be the next city, but I think it will probably be one of the next. But In any case, you know, our city series that we're doing here and that we're going to continue to do, and we've got some interesting week actually of content on that that will be coming up in not too long. But we'll be looking at some of these different cities and, you know, trying to understand what the local opportunities and challenges are with regard to both the current state of mobility and sort of future mobility technology, including autonomous vehicles. So as, you know, we get closer and closer to autonomous vehicles being a reality, the question of where they're going to be is becoming more and more important. So yeah, I think this is an
interesting data point about Miami is that for anyone of a certain age, I wouldn't place myself in this age, who spent any time on Miami Beach, the traffic there at night, especially weekend nights, is the worst in the world. Even people who have really good cars, and especially the idiots who rent Lamborghinis to cruise around to go to the club, regret it. They really regret it because the traffic is so awful. And I've seen too many, you know, Murcielagos and Aventadors overheating because they've been sitting in traffic for so long. It is the greatest city in America, ripe for self-driving cars because of nightlife traffic on the beach. But anyone who tries to deploy there that does not include some kind of orbit functionality is going to be in trouble, because the valets have cornered the market in blocking off streets with cones so they can get the cars back to the idiots dumb enough to bring their cars to down to the beach. It's going to be awesome to see how self-driving cars work down there or don't work.
Cool. Well, hey, other stuff happened, by the way. Aurora announced their Series A 90 mil, which is pretty decent for a Series A. And also, interestingly, you know, they have two new board members now too. So, you know, it was covered pretty well, but it just shows that they're ramping up and they're obviously probably going to start tapping in as much talent. We know even more based on someone we just recently spoke to that will be coming up in an upcoming episode, just how few specifically talented people that have that right skill set are. So, so to me, it's just like they're ramping up. I'm excited to see what they do.
Yeah. It's been interesting to see like an autonomous startup actually be in stealth mode and then actually get out of stealth mode, considering like how much of the space was just companies talking for a long time, not just, but predominantly there was a lot of talk. So,
and to come out of stealth mode with real clients.
Yeah. They've got real customers, or at least partners.
Well, they're already starting to do some work with Volkswagen. We know that. And we know they're going to be, you know, working with them on that Moya shuttle that kind of has come out in the past few weeks with Volkswagen. So
here's a question for you, Kirsten, since you seem to know so much about Aurora and your contacts are amazing. Hyundai is one of their customers. So like last week or 2 weeks ago, Hyundai announced that they had sent, I mean, I think the announcement was, you know, first self-driving drive across Korea. And there were a couple of cars, you know, crossing the length of Korea for the Olympics. And the announcements made it sound like it was level 4. And yet, digging around, it appeared that the cars were doing a path following and they were not actually level 4 vehicles. So is there any indication that Aurora had anything to do with those Hyundai vehicles that were crossing Korea?
I mean, I haven't heard anything. I suppose it's possible, but it would be a little surprising to me if they were involved in that, because it seems more of something that's driven by the company, whereas Aurora's, just their work culture seems to be more focused on like really not doing those types of demos.
Has Aurora done any demos yet? Now that you mention it.
No.
No, I mean, I've asked them about it, and what I've been given in return is, while there were thoughts about that in the past, the focus is on getting the work done and developing the system. So they're not doing that type of demo type stuff.
Yeah, which I think is really smart, because, I mean, let's face it, I mean, almost all demos are line following kind of things. They're not.
Are you saying that self-driving theater is the new security theater?
Yes, but only after giving you full credit for coming up with that fantastic analogy.
Let's move on to the California DMV.
We have new driverless testing and public use rules for autonomous vehicles now approved by the California DMV.
So what was amazing to me was, you know, I was unaware how many companies were working on teleoperation, because clearly a lot of people were rooting for this, but the language suggests that anyone who's doing this needs to have teleoperation enabled. So you got Phantom Auto with cars, you got Starsky Robotics with trucks, And I believe Waymo must have a teleoperation system in place. Am I crazy?
Why do you say that?
Well, if they didn't, they would have vehicles out there stranded, right?
Oh, you mean once they pull the...
You send out driverless vehicles for testing, and there's a failure. It stops. It sits there. There's no person inside.
There is a person inside.
We've all done demos at CES, and we know that oftentimes practices for a following car, a car to follow with humans.
There is someone inside the vehicle. They're just not right behind the wheel. So it's just a longer handoff, really. It's not like the vehicle is like stranded for an extended period of time, right?
Is that a question?
I think it is a question.
Something tells me something. I mean, I'm guessing that Waymo has teleoperation ability. I just cannot believe in a million years that they don't. But just conjecture.
We'll have to ask them.
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot. It's not crazy that they would, but I'd also say that there's a lot of other options, like having someone in the back seat or having a following car. Now, that's not feasible when you start talking about hundreds of cars in a fleet, but when just in an initial testing and pulling someone from behind the steering wheel doesn't mean that they can't exist somewhere else in the car or that they can't be in a car following during testing.
Right. So, and the big right, breakthrough with these new rules is that you can actually test a truly driverless vehicle. So it seems to me like there's a certain amount of maybe Arizona has put some pressure on California because California, I think, was pretty set on keeping a safety driver behind the wheel. Arizona has since come out and created a venue for, Waymo's truly driverless deployment. And now California's having to keep up. And I think it's interesting that they've had to, that they're doing that not the same way as Arizona, which kind of just sort of cleaned the rule book out, but they're actually creating rules and licensing for driverless testing. So a different approach, but clearly under some pressure to allow companies to test vehicles without drivers behind the wheel.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it could be viewed as in Arizona, it's via an executive order and the governor really wanting and pushing this and seeing this a future, certainly as an economic driver for the state. And that's paid off. I mean, you can see the number of companies that are in that area now. But if you look at the list of permit holders in California, there's no denying that there's just a multitude. I mean, what? 50, more than 50 now. And it just, whether some of those, it's just convenient for those companies that are based in Silicon Valley to now have this other option. It's just whether they want to deal with the red tape that might be involved in order to get those permits. But
right. And it's also one thing to get the permit. Like Tesla, for example, last year, they didn't actually test. So they had a permit, but they didn't do any miles, at least so they say, in California. So like you say, those even if they're getting those permits, the rules for like recording. And I think, we've talked a lot about disengagement reports. I think that's something that companies are very understandably nervous about, like creating a metric that you can directly compare, or people will directly compare whether they should or not, to their competitors.
That actually brings up an interesting point, because I think of Cruise. I mean, they've shown off a really interesting car, with no steering wheel or anything. That's a company that I would have to think that they have some sort of teleoperation, since there's, once that's produced, I don't know how you would take it over if there was no steering wheel, unless there's some sort of other control that you have in the car. But comparing disengagement reports now is going to be interesting, because there's the manual settings in a car are totally different now. I mean, I guess disengagements are the same, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know how.
Before we go down that road, it's not clear that they will be able to test it right away, because they've applied for an FMVSS waiver from the DOT. They have not, as far as I know, received such a waiver. One of the points in these new California rules is that your vehicle must either comply with FMVSS or have a valid waiver. So until they get that from the feds, you're not going to see steering wheel free bolts driving around San Francisco.
I would think, because it would be the smart thing to do, would be to be, lobbying in different ways. So first with the state in pushing that this recent rule, and also looking for, essentially a variance, I guess, with the federal government, while also, sure, designing and putting together the production of this steering wheel-less car.
Yeah.
You wouldn't do it in steps. You would do it all at the same time in hopes that it all comes together at the same time.
Yeah. And I'm curious if, you know, if waivers from FMVSS are going to be something that we're going to see a lot more of until the feds sort of establish more solid regulatory framework. Are we just going to see a lot more vehicles or companies sort of applying for these waivers or not? I don't know. I'm curious to see what happens there. Hmm. So speaking of other sort of new companies, not really new, but Toyota's making another huge investment, $2.8 billion, into something called Toyota Research Institute Advanced Development. This is sort of bridging the gap between Toyota proper, the car company, and Toyota Research Institute, which is their sort of also their software and autonomous vehicle advanced robotics development thing. So I think they invested they're investing $1 billion in TRI and another 2.8 into a billion into TRI AD. That's a lot of money that Toyota is spending.
So this is basically a Waymo type unit.
The details are a little sketchy still. My understanding is the research itself is being done at TRI. TRI AD is, it looks like sort of taking that advanced research and sort of developing it into a usable product. And the emphasis apparently is on bringing up the standard of quality of the software to a level that Toyota would feel comfortable putting it in its cars. It's actually interesting that they're spending $1 billion to develop it and then $2.8 billion making sure that the integration happens in a way that is truly safe enough. It kind of speaks a lot to how Toyota looks at the world and their customers and their business, and you know, very conservative in certain ways.
Do you know much about like how much of an overlap there will be between these two organizations?
Well, again, TRI AD is supposed to bridge the gap between TRI, which is again sort of, you know, advanced research, and Toyota itself, which is just a car company.
Right.
So I assume there's going to be, you know, very heavily involved with both sides of that. So interfacing with TRI on the research side and then essentially, you know, handling that relationship, mm-hmm. and ensuring again that the quality is good enough. So if you're curious about to hear more about TRI and what they do in this episode number 23 of the Autonicast is an interview with or conversation, I should say, with Dr. Gil Pratt, who's the CEO of TRI. Really interesting episode. I highly recommend you go check that out.
We're starting to get like a really good library, I think, of
impressive.
Like a year from now, I'd love to go back and listen to some of the interviews and see sort of where these people are at and have the promises they've made borne out, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of promises, well, so Jaguar finally showed its great electric
hope. I-Pace.
Yeah, the I-Pace. Alex, you are a connoisseur of fine automobiles, as well as fine electric automobiles. What's your take on the I-Pace?
It's awesome. The I-Pace is so cool. I mean, it's awesome. And Ian McCallum is a great car designer. Everybody says, "Oh, our designer is so great," but McCallum is really great.
So it's just Callum, but yeah, I totally agree with you. Callum is a genius.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. Ian McCallum is great. The I-Pace it's gorgeous. It's super cool.
So what is it? What is it specifically? I've actually been inside and ridden in the prototype. So it was all under wraps and you couldn't really, you know, you could kind of feel it. But what specifically on the design, what is it that you like that stands out so much?
It's a compact SUV, I guess, slash crossover. It's smaller than a Tesla Model X.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like an electric car. Like it looks like a Jaguar and it doesn't have these stupid accents that indicate it's a green vehicle. So it feels like a step forward without sacrifices towards green marketing, which make me want to vomit. So it's really cool. Did you guys see the video they released a couple of days ago where this massive kind of Top Gear type production?
Yeah, the live stream, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Despite how great the car is, they still fell into this trap of wanting to show off the acceleration. And
yeah.
They you know, Faraday did that when Faraday pulled out, you know, Model S, and they pulled out like a Ferrari to demonstrate that on stage at their catastrophically hilarious, you know, a couple of years ago. So Jaguar has this video. I guess they shot it in Austria and they hired some celebrities, some race car drivers, and they pull out an I-Pace and they bring out a Model X, Tesla Model X 75D. And they have a drag race. And the two drivers, you know, invent some drama. And the I-Pace beats the Model X 75D. And then you get to this moment, which was really beneath Jaguar, and I'm they shouldn't have done it. The driver who drove the X, who's Kanan, the driver, what, Tony Kanan, I think, he says, oh, you know, I need a faster car. I need something like a Model X P100D. Mm-hmm. Then they wheel out a Model X, but it's not, according to sources, a P100D. It's just a 100D. And then the I-Pace beats that. And then
that was also, it was 0 to 100 to 0 too, right? Where Tesla's just been focusing on that acceleration.
Correct.
This was acceleration and braking.
So first of all, this is not an apples to apples comparison. Secondly, this adopts the language and narrative of Tesla, and then tries to beat Tesla their own game, which is completely unnecessary. Mm. And Teslas themselves have moved past it because the Model 3 is not a rapidly accelerating vehicle. And I think Tesla feels they proved their points. I was kind of surprised to see Jaguar do this. I think it was unnecessary because the I-Pace on its own looks to be a winner. And when you look at the pricing, then you see really where the future lies for companies releasing well-made, well-designed electric cars. Because Kirsten, you did an analysis of the pricing, correct?
They're right now have only released the UK pricing. The US pricing is going to be announced at the Geneva Auto Show.
It might actually be out by the time this airs.
Oh, right. Yeah. So the UK pricing in US dollars, although, you know, you're buying it in pounds, is about 87,000. And that isn't to say that that vehicle in the US will be 87,000. I think that it will have to be the same price or lower than the Tesla Model X. And we're talking before incentives, because I like to think of things before any incentives happen, since those could disappear. The base model of the Model X, 75, we're talking about battery pack size, because that's what we're comparing, is 79,500. So I would think that the I-Pace has got to be at that or below it for it to be competitive. Now, I know Ed feels like it can be competitive even if it doesn't, right? I mean,
yeah. So, I mean, well, first of all, I want to push back a little bit on what Alex said about taking on Tesla. You know, I think the fact that they went and did a race that's 0 to 100 to 0, I just consider 0 to 60 or 0 to 100 to be a very one-dimensional metric. And like, obviously, I think, you know, Tesla's got it down to a point where, you know, the limiting factor is the rubber compound on the tires. So like, what's even the point? And what's, you know, under 3 seconds, it starts to even get like physically uncomfortable for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Trying to, you know, full on beat them is pointless, but I don't think they did. I think they started to widen the playing field. And I think that when you see the Porsche Mission E come out, I have the feeling that they will probably do some kind of, you know, Nürburgring lap time or something like that, that will continue to push EVs more towards the kind of broad range of performance metrics that we have for gas cars, instead of just focusing on this, you know, 0 to 100 or 0 to 60 acceleration. So I think that's good. I think what we're seeing is the premium electric car market is maturing. Competition will be good for everyone, including Tesla. I think they actually really need competition to prevent them from, I don't know, lapsing into a little bit of the self-congratulatory, sort of excusing away all the problems because, you know, they are so fast or they're the only ones who do this or that or whatever. The one thing that's important to remember about the I-Pace is that they haven't released production numbers for it, but I don't think it'll be more than about 15,000 units a year. This is not something that, you know, has to be some runaway success. At a certain point, they will be production constrained because it's being built by a contract manufacturer, Magna Steyr. So I think it will be very successful, though. There's no question about that in my mind.
So here's my question, though. I was thinking about this the other day. So Tesla has its own sort of network, supercharger network, to sort of promote and push people to drive their cars long distances. And I've driven Tesla's long distances before, and it's nice to know where those supercharger networks are, and it's great to use, and it makes it pretty chill to drive between California and Arizona. And I know that certainly Jaguar will be able to access sort of a different kind of DC fast charging network that's publicly available. Those can be a little bit more difficult to find, or they can be highly concentrated. So do you guys think that at 237, which is the single charge mileage, that this is primarily going to be people in the luxury market, that this is their second car, and that they're never going to, it's like never going to go mainstream? Will it be held back by the fact that it's difficult to drive it long distances.
Yeah, I don't think so at all.
I don't think so either. I think people are going to use it as their second car. How many people are taking Model X's on road trips? Or any Teslas on big road trips?
Like three extremely vocal people who will not stop posting on social media.
Well, okay. Okay. Besides that, I will say that I stopped every single, I've done this twice now, every single supercharger network between Orange County into LA, San Diego, and then all the way over to Tucson. And granted, on one of the trips, it was Thanksgiving Sunday, Thanksgiving weekend. So it was definitely like probably not the best sample group. It was in some cases packed.
Yeah.
Now on a Tuesday, would that be the case? On a non-holiday weekend? Probably not.
Yeah.
There were three chargers in the middle of nowhere in which I didn't see anyone. And then as I left, I saw someone pulling in. It's not like every single one is packed, but they were being used. I mean, and they were all super vans.
Yeah.
For sure. Because I talked to them all.
I think superchargers were really important. Like a lot of things that Tesla has done, they were really important in kicking off this transition towards the acceptance, widespread acceptance of electric cars. I think having a really long range battery and having really fast chargers, there was a psychological resistance to electric cars. Same thing with their performance, right? I don't think most people care about a sub-3-second performance for their, you know, sedan that they're probably just commuting in. But it proved that electric cars could do, you know, things in some ways better than gas cars or almost as well. And let's face it, I mean, even with the superchargers, you know, road tripping an electric car, if you need to get a long distance fast, it's still not going to be as quick as being able to pull over real quick and fill up with gas. It just isn't.
Right. It adds, like, you know, for me, it added about an hour, I would say, total to the
right
to
so,
the time.
So yeah. I think it's been really important in the transition, but I think that as the transition sort of takes hold and like electric cars stop being this like strange, scary, weird thing that people don't know about or understand, I think it's just gonna be less and less important all the time. And the real opportunity for electric cars is for, you know, the people who are driving, you know, 30 miles a day for their commute, which is most people. And that's the application where I think, you know, electric cars have the opportunity to sell like crazy, not necessarily these expensive, long range, you know, fast charging premium.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to sort of disagree with you. I'm going to say that the fact that you can supercharge at all is a huge plus for a subset of people. And there's certainly a culture around it. And I think that the I-Pace, because it's a luxury vehicle, and I think a lot of people who have them are going to have home chargers. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be non-issue. But for anyone with money who lives in a major city who cannot install a home charger, someone like myself, the I-Pace is a non-starter. But I would consider a Tesla. You have to subdivide the country and look at the cities where it's going to work and not work. The supercharger network is, I mean, I would absolutely get one. If I didn't already have a Morgan three-wheeler.
Okay, well, we're running real low on time here. I do want to give a shout out real quick before we go to Ryan Felton at Jalopnik. He had a great story where he spoke to the father of a man who died in China while autopilot was apparently activated in the car. Great story, really well reported. If you listen to this show, you're probably going to enjoy this piece. So go check that out.
Cool.
What are you working on, Edward?
I am, I'm working on the same thing I've been working on for a little while now, and I will be continuing to work on that. So, yeah, nothing really to talk about in terms of my work right now, but, you know, come bug me on Twitter at Tweetermeyer.
Nice.
Kirsten Korosek.
Nice. I like the inflection. So what am I working on? I'm working on a little magazine piece, but actually, one thing that's come up recently is Arizona Tech Summit. I've been asked to moderate a panel there, and it's going to be autonomous vehicle focused. So that should be fun and interesting, and we're still working on a pretty cool guest list. I'm excited about that. Yeah, and you can find me at Kirsten Korosek on Twitter.
Wonderful. And I, of course, am working on the Human Driving Association, which is not opposed to self-driving technology, but we are in support of parallel automation. And while we wait for level 4
to arrive, Who's we?
It's the editorial we.
It's a noble we. It's a we who agrees with me and doesn't know it yet. We support safety, which means we support TRI's Guardian technology and anyone else who's offering parallel automation.
And they also have really cool t-shirts. So check that out.
Well, I'm trying not to plug the t-shirts, but you can find me on all platforms at AlexRoy144. And I don't feel it's ethical for me to plug a product like that. But of course, there's some. You could look up the Human Driving Association t-shirts by looking up human driving.
So my question is, why haven't you created AutonoCast t-shirts for us yet?
Easily done. I was just thinking about it. And they would be, would they be in opposition? Would they be the self-driving association?
Well, I think part of the problem is we don't have a logo yet, guys.
I know. In progress.
I've got an idea.
In progress. Well, maybe we should shout out to folks who have really fun ideas for what we should have as AutonoCast merch. They should definitely reach out to us.
Yeah, post on our Facebook wall.
Yeah, great idea.
Facebook.com/AutonoCast.
All right, guys. Well, then signing off. See you next week.
Cool.
Ciao.